Welcome to VI Talk, sharing ideas, information, and support.
Hi everyone, it's Jo here, and it's a pleasure to invite back on the podcast Dave Williams. Hi Dave.
Hi Jo, good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. So we're not here to talk about Braille this time. We're here to talk about running. So Dave, I know you've done a podcast with us before, but for those who haven't heard that, we hope they have, but if they haven't, how did you get started with running?
I was one of those people who hated PE at school. You know, I always thought that people invented wheels so we didn't have to run, you know, leave the running to the horses, right? And I got to the age of 42. I couldn't run a bath. I was 16 stone. And what I really wanted to do, Jo, was go cycling. I've got a tandem collecting dust in my garage. And I knew there was this database that British Blind Sport and England Athletics had set up to enable blind people to connect with guide runners. And my thought was I would try and get hold of one of these guide runners and convert them into a tandem pilot. And so the short version of the story is that I failed miserably and they got me running. They wouldn't take no for an answer. It was horrible at first. You know, I just wanted to give up, and it felt like too much like hard work. And the guy who I ran with initially kept encouraging me. He kept turning up. You know, he said, if you don't keep at it, Dave, you're not going to get any better. I did what I later discovered was couch to 5K. And I got to my first park run in October 2018, and having got round the park run in just over half an hour, I got the bug. I thought, you know what, I can probably do better than that if I come back and have another go. And I did. And you know, your times come down, and then you think, well, okay, I've done a few park runs, what else is there? You know, maybe go a little bit further, maybe do 10k. And then it was Louise Simpson, who is known in the community. She is a prolific runner. She's done over 100 marathons. She's done nearly 500 park runs. Just unbelievable. And she contacted me and let me know about a campaign to improve the recognition of guide runners at London Marathon, because before 2019, if you guided London Marathon, you didn't appear in the results and you also didn't officially receive a finisher's medal. Now, in practice, you did, because the volunteers didn't know the rules, so they just gave out the finisher's medal anyway. And this campaign had been rattling around in the media, and Louise said to me, you know, we've got to get this on In Touch. And I knew the producer of In Touch at the time, and I'd pitched the idea and they weren't really interested. And then maybe they had a slow week or something, because they came back to me and said, right, can you get us an interview with, you know, a guide runner and a blind runner and explain why this is important? I did. They broadcast it. The policy was changed and I was super excited, like, wow, you know, we've made a difference, not just me, but, you know, the whole effort had succeeded, yeah. That whole piece of advocacy. And I realized in my excitement that I hadn't really checked what happens at other marathons around the world. Like, are guide runners recognized elsewhere or not? I went online to try and find out, and I chose to do that after spending the evening in the pub. Alcohol and the internet are always a winning combination. And I found myself on the ballot entry page for the New York City Marathon. And I entered, and I received an email a month later that said, dear Mr. Williams, congratulations, you've got a place in the 2019 New York City Marathon. Well, I thought it was a wind-up, you know. And I checked my bank account, and New York Roadrunners had taken $270 out of my current account. Oh my days, this is real, right? Very real. And I now have to perhaps start telling people that I've done this, because as soon as I'd filled in the form, I regretted it. I thought, what are you doing, you idiot, you know.
Did you ever at that point think about cancelling it, seeing if you could cancel the place, or did you kind of have that stubbornness that just kind of went, right, I've got to do this?
Well, anybody who's tried to enter one of these big city marathons, particularly through a ballot, knows that these things are like lottery tickets.
They,
you know,
are.
That
yeah.
They're very, very hard to get in. And this is why so many people run for charity and they raise thousands of pounds, because if it's something that you really want to do, often running for charity you know, the way in. And so I knew that I got something that lots of other runners would covet and would want for themselves, you know, that this was an opportunity that I really shouldn't waste. But at the same time, I'd absolutely no idea how I would do it. What I did have was a bit of time, because the New York ballot is in the February usually, and the marathon itself is in November. So you've got 9 months to kind of get your act together, you know, and do some training. And I was up to probably about 10 miles at this point. And so, you know, I knew that if I could just really apply myself, I might get to New York and I might just about get round. You know, it was never going to be quick or anything like that. But I did it, and I came back and I was absolutely high as a kite for a couple of days. And then, you know, you get that kind of post-marathon blues where you've had this incredible experience, and then what do you do? What next? Right, running, done that, you know, tick that, yeah. done me marathon. And most people who ever do a marathon, they'll only ever do one. Yeah. And I'd loved it so much. It was so exciting. The streets filled with people, the energy, the music. Yes, it was hard, but it was so like rewarding and satisfying that somebody who, you know, just over a year earlier hadn't really done any running at all, never thought of myself as a runner. I'd lost a load of weight. I mean, I'm not virtuous, right? I still love the pub and I still love a pipe of Pringles. But I had made some improvements, you know, to my diet, and I'd started becoming a little bit more aware of my body and how to sort of look after myself a bit more. So somebody told me that if I did the London Marathon, right, I would have done 2 of the 6. Oh no, why have you told me that? You know, six? What? So it turns out there's a series, the Abbott World Marathon Majors Series, 6 big city marathons, London, New York, Boston, Chicago, Berlin, and Tokyo, right? And so I was hooked. I was just fascinated. I wanted to know more. Like, was it even possible? Had any blind people even attempted to do all of them, right? And they have, by the way. And so I think the pandemic just made me more determined, right? I've just got to do this. So so as we talked about last time in 21, I ran London Marathon for the first time. And in 2022, I was very lucky to get a place and run in the Boston Marathon, which is iconic. You know, it really is.
Yeah.
You know, and I talked a lot about those three.
Yes.
Last time.
Yes. But since then.
Oh, yeah.
As you say, you got the bug.
Since then, my credit card's taken quite a bit of hammer. is what. So I had to go on and try and do the rest, basically.
Yeah. So tell us about the rest then, Dave. Which one came fourth?
Well, the number four was Berlin for me. Mm-hmm. And I'd been to like Germany, you know, a couple of times, you know, for work related things. Never done any running in Germany. The other thing that had kind of changed as well at this point, because the first two marathons I'd run with Bex, who I talked about on the previous podcast. She's a teacher. She lives locally. We've run thousands of miles together. We've run, you know, lots of park runs. I think she said to me the other day, she thinks we might have done 78 park runs together. We have a, you know, fantastic relationship, really good friends. Somebody told me, if you know somebody for 7 years or you're friends with somebody for 7 years, you're friends for life. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I feel like we could be friends for a very long time. And anyway, she had a lot of stuff going on in her personal life that meant that she couldn't come to Boston with me. And so there was another guy, Matt, who I run with, and he stepped up and he came to Boston and he guided Boston. And I think he enjoyed most of it. It was a tough day, but we got there, and it was you know, it was exciting. And so he said he would come to Berlin. So we did. We flew to Berlin together. And of course, you know, we were able to share a room as well, which is not something, you know, I'm able to do. I'm a married man, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That sort of helps with the cost, because these things are expensive, you know.
Yeah, and for sure.
feel very lucky to be in the position to have been able to at least, you know, borrow the money and pay it back or whatever, you know, or save up a little bit to make it happen. And the first two trips, like Boston and New York, I'd taken the family and we'd made a family holiday out of both of those trips. Whereas Berlin, because it's, you know, it's only an hour away or something on a flight, and it's the end of September, the Berlin Marathon, I was able to just kind of pop over for the weekend. So we went on the Friday, and then on the Saturday, you know, we went to pick up our race number. And my dad, who lives in Austria, he got the train. And so he came to watch me run for the first time. He hadn't seen me do any of running. So, yeah, we went out for dinner the night before, and he came and watched the watched the marathon. And I think Kipchoge, it turns up at a lot of these things, Eliud Kipchoge, you know, he ran, you know, a stunning time. And it was my goal, because having at this point run, you know, three or four marathons, I still hadn't got under 4 hours. And that was my goal for Berlin. I really knew that it's a fast course. It's really flat. It's tarmac. So it's not as hard on your knees as London is. You know, some of London's like concrete, and it's really tough
and
on your knees.
Some hills in London as well.
Yeah, I mean, look.
But there are some.
Massive. I mean, look, New York and Boston are lumpier. Yeah. But Berlin, pancake flat. And so... And it finishes at the Brandenburg Gate. Well, actually, it finishes a couple of hundred meters on from the Brandenburg Gate. And that's the important thing, that when you run through the gate at the finish, don't stop because you're not at the end. You've still got a little bit to go. You know.
Don't think it's over.
Yeah. And Matt was sort of in the orange. You know, he was hanging on a bit at the end. And I thought, he said, just no faster than this, Dave. You know, he said, all right, or we'll have to stop, basically. And we just edged in. And I think it was like, you know, 3:59 and change or something. So we just did it. And I couldn't have been happier. And I thought, well, if I never run a sub 4 hour marathon again, at least I can say I've done it once. I mean, I have done it since. And I did take another 12 minutes off that in London the year after. But yeah, that was Berlin, and there were people all the way around. I don't really remember like masses about, you know, all the landmarks and stuff. You know, you go past the you know, the German Parliament. I mean, the iconic thing is the Brandenburg Gate. You know,
yeah, which is where
you get beer at the end as well. You know, somebody there with the Erdinger or whatever. You know, at the end of the Berlin Marathon. But then it was straight back to the airport, and I was home for like 11 o'clock the same day. Back to Worcester, you know, so
that's amazing.
Yeah, so Berlin's a really good one to do, actually, and it's less expensive, I would say, obviously, than some of the ones that are further afield. But even the place, you know, I think it's more than London, but it's less than the American ones, and certainly less than Tokyo. So, so that was number four, and then number five was Chicago. Chicago, my kind of town, you know, all this kind of thing. Well, it is my kind of town, because the thing about Chicago is it's a bit like New York, but without the sort of the urgency. And it's on a kind of a lakefront, Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
And Chicago, famously, lots of skyscrapers. Your GPS is all over the place with the Chicago Marathon. And again, Matt came, and we hooked up with Achilles International, support disabled runners around the world. And so we connected up with those guys, who meant that we had some shelter before the start of the race, and we were you know, supported to kind of get into the start in a good position and all of that. So they were super helpful. And of course, Chicago, you know, very famous for the blues, right? And jazz and all that music. So when we weren't running that weekend, we were hanging out in various music establishments. The other thing that was really fun about Chicago, a few months before, a British guy had put a message on one of the Facebook groups saying, any Brits coming to Chicago, I'm thinking about organizing a trip to Parkrun. So Parkrun is a, you know, hundreds of venues up and down the country each and every week, really popular. Thousands and thousands of people go to Parkrun. It's just growing in the US now, but they are kind of quite thinly spread in terms of you've got to travel if you want to go to a park run. Most, you know, towns of a, you know, substantial size in the UK have a park run, or,
yeah,
you know, in the case of Worcester, we've got two. Anyway, so a couple of people came back, and then a few more people came, and a few more people came. In the end, he organized a coach load of people to go from Chicago out to Cornerstone Lakes for park run. And because the demand was such, he had to organize a second coach, basically. So there was two coaches of Brits went. Well, the police came, I think, as much to protect the Brits from, you know, like, I don't know what they thought would happen, but basically there was like a, you know, 100 over enthusiastic British runners like turned up at this. I think it was like their highest ever attendance, you know.
Yeah.
So that was incredible. And, you know, people were very, you know, warm and welcoming, as they always are at park run. And then I think it might have drizzled a little bit during the Chicago Marathon. And that was the one. There's a guy who sadly passed away in a road accident. There's a guy called Kelvin Kipton who still holds the world record for the marathon. And he ran in that race. And I think that's the thing that appeals to me about this, is that as a blind person, you are, with, you know, the smallest of adaptations in holding onto a tether or whatever, or running, you know, with a guide runner, you are running on the same road and you are doing the same thing as all the other tens of thousands of participants.
Yeah.
So you're running on the same streets as the great, you know, it'd be like, if you like tennis, going to play at Wimbledon, you know, you can't do that in most sports, right? Most people who play football socially won't get to play at Wembley, you know, whereas if you run, you can go and run on the same road as the elites.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is true.
I think that's part of the attraction of it for me.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I bet that's something that none of us really think about, to be honest. You know, you just thought, oh yeah, marathons and things. But actually, that's a really good point.
It's very inclusive, you know, because you've got people in wheelchairs, sometimes hand cycles. You know, you've got amputees, people with different disabilities, deaf runners, you know, all, you know, types of person, young and old, from, you know, different backgrounds.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and you don't have to go to a, you know, a big city one. I love the buzz of a big city marathon, because the whole city kind of gears up for it the week before. Everyone's kind of excited. Everyone's chatting about it. You know, people want to know, are you running, you know, and is this your first one? Oh, I've got an injury. And, you know, it's not long before runners start talking and comparing injuries and all of that stuff. You know? So, yeah. So that was... That was Chicago, and that was in 2023. And then I wanted to finish the set. I had, if you imagine an egg box with, you know, six spaces, but five little eggs in there. And I just wanted to fill that last one to complete the set, you know. And so my dream was to go to Tokyo in 2024. And could I get in? Could I egg? I tried everything that I could think of. I bid for places, wasn't successful. I went in drawings, I entered competitions, I looked at trying to do there's a company called Sports Tours, you know, and they sold out. I was on various waiting lists, and try as I might, I just could not get in. So 2024 wasn't to be. And I did run marathons in 2024. You know, ran the London Marathon again, and Manchester, and they were a week apart this year. They were on the same day, but in 2024, they were a week apart. So I did those. And right at the end of 2023, that was when Louise, who I mentioned earlier, ran her 100th marathon.
Wow.
And I wanted to record a podcast with her about it, which went out on RNIB Connect Radio. You know, where I was doing some work at the time, and Louise said to me, because she hates all this, she wouldn't, you know, if you asked her to come on, Joe, she'd just say, to be honest, it's not for me, right?
Yeah.
And so she said to me, because it's you asking, she said, I will record a podcast with you. She said, but on one condition, you've got to come and run this marathon with me, basically.
Oh, wow.
And she'd chosen a marathon in Slough, of all places, the week before Christmas. So it was like the shortest day of the year. It was pouring with rain. It was blowing a hooly. It was a horrible track that was alongside a river that was like a sort of a 2.5 mile track, and you ran down it and then you ran back, and you had to do that five times basically to do a marathon. I mean, it was just like, what's the matter with you? You know, I like smooth roads and big cities, you know, with the water stations and all the rest of it. And the other thing that happens with some of these smaller marathons is you can just start when you like. So normally in a big city marathon, you are allotted a corral and a start wave, and you start at a very specific time, you know. And with this, I turned up, met my guide runner, and I went to the start, very small, and I spoke to the registration. I said, "Oh, is Louise here yet?" And they went, "Oh yeah, she's been running for about an hour." Like, you are? And she started at 6:30 in the morning or something. And they said, "Oh yeah, you can just start whenever you want, really. There's no, you know." And
it's bizarre.
Yeah, and somebody just stands there with a stopwatch and they just note down the time when you start running, and that's it.
That's mad. I've never heard of that before. That's a new one on me.
Well, and of course, then I wanted to catch her, but I was an hour behind her. So I think it took me 18 miles before I caught up with her, but did in the end, yeah. And I got my interview, so I was very happy about that. So Tokyo, that was the final piece of the jigsaw. And so I decided that what I would do is I would bid again, and I would go quite high with my bid. So the way the charity places work in the Tokyo Marathon is that you have to pay it all up front, but it's in at a closed auction, basically. So you have to specify how much you're willing to donate, and then they come back and tell you whether you've been successful.
Right.
And you've no idea, really, of whether or not your bid's going to be successful. Yeah. And you only get one shot at this, and if you try multiple, then they'll, you know, disqualify you from the process or whatever. So, you know, it's really fiddly. And of course, the thing about Japanese culture as well, it's a very rule-based society. You know, it's all about, you know, respect, and you have to, I mean, when I got to Japan, I got to my hotel 2:05, and our check-in time was 2:00, and we went to the desk and the guy said, "Oh no, you have to come back at 2:00. I'm like, "Yeah, well, it's 5:02. Like, can we not just check in?" And he's like, "No, you've got to come back at 2:00. Like, you're kidding." You know, which obviously from a British point of view sounds mad, right? But they have their rules and they stick to them, and you just have to kind of accept that, because if you don't, you're just gonna be miserable.
Yeah.
So you just have to go with it. So I went through this whole closed auction process, and I supported the Japanese Parasport Association. It was the charity that I could, you know, when I looked through all the charities, the one that sort of seemed closest to, you know, what I'm sort of about. And so I made a bid to the Japanese Parasport, and I'd kind of done a little bit of research online to find out, like, what does, you know, a successful bid look like, and then just try and go a little bit kind of north of that. So, yeah, the credit card took a bit of a hammer on that.
Dare we ask what you bid, or is that a secret?
So I bid, it was around, so bear in mind it's in Japanese yen that you've got to bid. So I bid around 200,000 Japanese yen, which I think at the time was somewhere around 800 quid, right? I know this sounds like ludicrous. Like, why would you spend that amount of money to go and run a marathon on the other side of the world, right? I mean, I understand how stupid. I mean, if people who know me know, I've got a child, I've got responsibilities, I've got a mortgage. Yeah. And I did talk with my wife about this. I didn't just go off like I did with New York and just sort of enter. You know, it's like, "Love, I am going to have to, you know, basically spend a lot of money to finish this." You know, and you know, I'd been saving up and all of that, and it went to a charity, right? I mean, it did. So that's you know, I don't feel as bad. At least it didn't go to like a corporation or something,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And some people run for like water aid and stuff like that. So I knew like three or four other people from my running club who were also going, who were also going to be, you know, getting charity places. And that yeah. was the sort of the going rate, you yeah. know. And this had been my dream for 7 or 8 years or something, mm-hmm. you know, that I just really wanted to get this over the line.
Yeah.
And so that's what it was. And again, I went with Matt, so we were able to share a room. And we got there early on the Thursday morning, and we knew that we had to get into the time zone as quickly as we could, because Tokyo is 8 hours ahead of the UK. Mm-hmm. And it's a long old flight, you know, it's like 12 hours or something. And so we tried as much as we could to stay awake on the Thursday. You know, we went and found food and everything. And I mean, it's just that you really feel like you are abroad. So when you go to Germany, you know, I mean, the Germans are a lot like us, you know, they're kind of beer and sausage people, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, and all, like we've got German supermarkets and German white yeah. goods and, you know, so it's not like going to Mars, like going yeah. to Germany, you know, it, there's a lot of things in Germany that kind of feel familiar.
Yeah.
And you go to Japan and it is so different because, you know, lots of people just don't speak a word of English. I mean, in Tokyo, you know, a lot of people do speak a little bit of English, but it isn't unusual to go into a shop or, you know, to go into a restaurant or something and the staff not be able to kind of speak any English, right? And I'd got one of these, like, learn Japanese in an hour, you know, kind of courses, and I'd listen to it every night for 6 months, and it still didn't, you know, go into my tiny little brain. So I did have to make quite a bit of use of Siri to translate stuff into Japanese.
You know,
and the other thing I sort of learned, you know, a little bit about, because I've traveled a bit over the years for work and obviously for the marathons and stuff like that, you know, I've kind of developed a few little tips and techniques. So, for example, I carry a photograph of my suitcase on my phone so that when you go to the baggage carousel, if you're with somebody that doesn't speak any English, you can at least show them a picture of your suitcase.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah. So things like that. And then, you know, I always sort of take the time to just sort of, you know, explore the hotel room and check stuff out. And of course, AI is great for translation as well. Mm. So you can take a picture of something that's written in Japanese and, you know, sort of ask it to tell you what it means in English or whatever. And it's not always going to be, you have to sense check stuff, right? It's not always going to be perfect. There was lots of Braille as well. You know, I just found in the kind of in the built environment and the famous Japanese toilets that have like just an absurd amount of buttons and features and functions. You know, I mean, these things will wash your bum and everything. I mean, honestly, it's quite frightening. And I said to Matt, you know, I said, you're going to be the kind of the lavatory technician. You can tell me what all these buttons do, because while they've got Braille on, of course, they're Japanese Braille characters, right? So I don't know what any of them mean. And he pressed a button and this sort of jet of water came out. you know, there was a few moments like that. And it's a tricky old place. See, I'm vegetarian as well. And it's a tricky old place to visit if you're vegetarian. Vegetarian food is available. But a lot of the time, you know, ramen is based on meat stock or fish stock, right? And I don't eat meat or fish. And so when you ask for something vegetarian, you'll get a great big bowl of vegetables, but often it'll be swimming in a beef stock or a fish stock, you know. So you've just got to be really clear about that. And I have to confess, I might have gone into the Golden Arches a couple of times just because I knew what I was dealing with. You know, can I just have some chips, you know? So
needs must sometimes.
Indeed. And I did go on the famous bullet train in Japan as well. And there was Braille again at the end of the coaches. And also when you go on the train, like in the metropolitan areas, so when you're in the city, you go on the train and it's so quiet. Like everybody's really quiet, like not speaking. Wow. And there's an expectation that you have your phone set to silent as well when you're on the train. So there's none of this, you know, sometimes you go on the train and you can hear, you know, Larry you know, people playing their music or whatever out of their phone speakers. Absolutely none of that in Tokyo. And also, it is frowned upon to eat and drink in public in Tokyo. So in a restaurant, in a designated area. But certainly not on public transport. Wow. You know, you wouldn't be having a Greg sausage roll on the way into work or, you know.
That's just, that's just culturally different. And it probably takes just a little bit of research, doesn't it, before you go somewhere like that to be respectful of their customs and everything.
Right. And but then immaculate, right? Just really, really clean, really tidy. People queue up in very straight lines. When you go to the ticket barrier, the default is that the ticket barrier is open unless you don't scan a ticket. And if you don't scan a ticket, then it snaps shut, you know?
Right.
As soon as you go to try and step through it, if you've not scanned the ticket, it will close on you. But the default is, the expectation is, why wouldn't you have a ticket? Why would you be trying to break the rules? Because people just don't, you know? You know, just a different mindset.
Yeah, for sure. Gosh.
So, and it's the only marathon, Joe, that I've ever done, which was mostly like Brits and Australians and Europeans at parkrun. But when I got to the marathon on the Sunday morning, it's the only marathon I've ever done where before the start of the marathon, they do an announcement about what to do in the event of an earthquake. So they said, you know, if there's an earthquake, the marathon will be cancelled.
And you'd like to think so,
you'd like
you?
To think so. And it said, and they said, you must stop running immediately and make your way to the side of the road and follow instructions or whatever. I mean, I don't know whether that would actually happen, like whether people would run faster, like, you know, I don't know. But there was my guide runner said, again, the road was just, it was the smoothest surface. I think there was only like one pothole in the whole thing.
Wow.
But the challenge with the 2025 Tokyo Marathon was the heat. It was so warm, unseasonably warm.
Right.
And having trained through, you know, a British winter, to find myself in 25 degrees or whatever it was just a lot, you know. And we didn't have the fastest of days. I mean, Matt and I have run, you know, a couple of sub 4 marathons, but it was nearer to 5 hours. But and they ran out of cups as well for the water, you know. But they, you know, how could that happen? You know, you sort of scratch your head a little bit. And it turns out that there was some system where you were supposed to go, depending on a color on your bib, you were supposed to go to a particular drink station. Well, of course, you know, a lot of the international runners hadn't read all those rules, you know, so they just sort of grabbed water where they could. A tricky day, but lovely, lovely people, really welcoming, well supported, not quite as leery as, say, London Marathon or you know, some of the American ones. But definitely a lot of support and a lot of respect, and beautifully, they've got Braille on the medal as well. So I was very, very happy about that. So it says Tokyo Marathon 2025. So, came around that final corner. There's a turn by the train station. And I just allowed myself like a little moment of, you know what, Williams, you've done a thing here. You know, these 6 big city marathons. Who would have thunk it? You know, at the age of 42, when you started on this journey, you know, I just couldn't really believe it, you know, and I still pinch myself when I think, wow, you know.
Yeah, that's amazing. Congratulations, Dave. That's so, you earned that because you really worked hard to get there, didn't you? And, you know, you've been working towards this for a long time.
The reason I'm banging on about it, right, and the reason I've agreed to do this is because I want people to understand that you are capable of so much more than you believe. And I honestly, had you said to me 10 years ago, you'll run, you know, the Abbott World Marathon Majors, or even one marathon, or even a park run, I would have laughed you out the pub. I mean, honestly, I was the last person, people who've known me for a while know that I was the last person who would ever do anything like that. And so I'm not saying go and run a marathon, but you are capable of more than you think. You really are.
Yeah, for sure. So what's next for you then after doing the majors?
Well, so the sting in the tail, and anybody who reads about the majors may already be aware, they've decided that after 20 years of there being six majors, they've decided, Abbott, in their wisdom, that they want to extend the series. And so they're going to add a seventh, an eighth, and a ninth major.
Oh, no. And do we know what they're going to be?
Yeah, we do. So the first of those is Sydney. So the 2025 Sydney Marathon, which will be on the 31st of August, will be a major.
Okay.
Yeah. And then obviously a major, you know, from here on.
Yeah.
There is a candidacy process that a race has to go through because there's over 100 criteria these races have to meet in order to qualify and be accepted as majors. And you've got to go through this sort of 3-year process. So the expectation is that Cape Town in 2026 will be a major. That's not confirmed yet.
Okay.
And Shanghai is the other candidate race that possibly by 27 may become a major as well.
So is it your plan to do them?
Oh dear. I'm in quite deep now with this, you know.
Was that a really silly question to ask you?
Well, I am going to Sydney. And we'll just see.
Have you got a place for this year?
I have, yeah. I know.
Wow.
I've also
you thought Tokyo was a long way, Dave.
I know. I've also got a bit of a dicky hip as well, so so it could be a long day. And there's another guy who I know doing them. There's the fantastic runner, Mark Rogerson, and he finished the majors, I think, last year. And the first six anyway. And he runs all of the runner as well. He's run all of them with the same person. So, you know, it's a remarkable achievement. And he, like me, wasn't naturally a runner, you know, and sort of came to it, I think, you know, a little bit later. So, yeah, I kind of feel like I'm really invested in his story and you know, this. I mean, what next is the question, right? If I don't carry on with the majors, then I've got to do something else. And there are other things that you can do. There's, you know, there's triathlons. I can't really swim.
I'm sure you could if you put your mind to it.
Well, look, I mean, I went last Wednesday with my son because he's finished his exams now, and we went to our local swimming baths. And honestly, Joe, it took me about 3/4 of an hour to swim about 600 meters. It was awful. I mean, I can literally run 10 times faster than I can swim.
Yeah. So you've got a place for Sydney. That's amazing. So we'll want to hear all about that. So how long are you going to Sydney for?
Well, so because it was really difficult with the jet lag and stuff in Tokyo and the heat and everything, I hadn't really properly acclimatized, I don't think. I'm going to try and go for a little bit longer if I can. So yeah, I'm hoping to go for about a week at the end of August. So yeah, watch this space. But you know, just on back on that point, you know, yes, this is a ridiculous, absurd kind of hobby to have found myself getting into, but you just don't know what you're capable of until you try. And so just kind of keep on keeping on, right? And you know, things will get better if you're somebody who's struggling or whatever. And you know, I was pretty miserable about my own sort of physical self-image. You know, I was carrying quite a lot of weight, and you know, I wouldn't, if the phone rang upstairs, I wouldn't run upstairs to answer the phone. I mean, I really wouldn't. And I didn't mind a bit of cycling. I thought, well, I could do a bit more of that. That was my thought. And running for me just kind of came from nowhere. And the generosity, and I spoke about this before, the generosity of spirit that you find from other runners. And everybody's so encouraging and supportive. And there are lots of groups. I know we've got the, you know, the VI Talk Sport group as well, you know, and that can be a great starting point if you've got questions and you're wanting to get started with an activity, you've got an idea about something you'd like to do. But there are, of course, other groups out there as well, you know, and lots of resources and activity finders and things like
that. Yeah, absolutely. Things are so much better than they were. They're not perfect by any stretch, but there are things that we can get involved with. And, you know, if sort of really high physical sport like running and things isn't your thing, there are other sports, aren't there, that aren't quite so, you know, high impact or something, you know, or even if you've got other health issues or other disabilities that go along your visual impairment, you know, along with your visual impairment, you've got other things that you can have a go at.
Right. And I know VI Talk organise the dancing, you know, weekends as well.
We do.
You know, which is another way to get moving.
Yeah.
Just going for a walk. You know, if you can find a friend or somebody. And, you know, even Parkrun, they promote Park Walk, which is part of Parkrun, where people just turn up and walk around the park, you know, for an hour. And that's fine as well. And you're very welcome to do that and then join, you know, for a coffee and a cake or whatever afterwards. It's a wonderful community. And it's also a great way for us as blind people to improve our visibility in our local communities as well, so that people know we exist, you know, and that we're capable of, you know, of walking around a park or whatever. Right. And it's a good way to meet people, learn about what's happening locally. You just build, you know, friendships. The friends I've made through this have just been tremendous.
Yeah, for sure. And I think sometimes we kind of think, oh, you know, a gym's not accessible, and maybe it isn't. But sometimes it just takes a bit of research to find the right person. You know, if you want to go to an exercise class, or maybe you want to go to a Pilates class, something like that, sometimes you just have to shop around a bit until you find the right person that fits for you and that's prepared to give you that bit of perhaps extra support and be a bit more hands-on or something. And sometimes it might not be the first person you come across, but don't give up.
It's scary to ask the first time.
You know, it is.
Like to ask somebody the first time, like, oh, would you consider coming for a walk with me, or would you consider, you know, coming to the gym or to an exercise class or what, you know, whatever it is, because of course, you know, the fear of rejection, or, you know, that somebody might think, oh God, you know, what else are you going to ask me? And you know, you don't want to lose a friend or whatever. And so I understand that, but most people are quite understanding. And even if they're not the right person, then they might help you find the right person. And sometimes maybe the way to ask isn't to ask directly. It's just let people know, look, I'm looking for somebody who would do this with me, you know, rather than saying, would you be the person who would do this with me? You know, kind of put it in the third person, and you'd be amazed when, you know, the amount of people who would volunteer. And I can tell you, a lot of people on the Guide Runner database, they never hear from anybody. You know, sometimes running clubs, they put on these guide running courses of runners, you know, they do the course or whatever, and they do a little bit of awareness training or whatever, and then they never hear from any blind runners.
Really?
And so people are out there, right? And also, you think of something like Be My Eyes, and I appreciate Be My Eyes is like a global thing, but there are 8 million sighted volunteers on Be My Eyes, and about 800,000 blind people, right? So the ratio really works in our favour in terms of the support that's out there.
Absolutely. I've got friends who signed up to be volunteers on Be My Eyes, and they'll say to me, you know, I've not had many takers, you know. So and I think it is hard, isn't it? Doing it that first time, linking with a volunteer, can be quite daunting. Can't say, oh, I'm quite a reclusive person, or I'm a bit shy, you know. But actually, once you've done it that first time, it's not quite so bad, is it?
I felt like a complete pranny, honestly. The first time when I started running, I had a cotton t-shirt and I had big thick jogging bottoms and some old like dog walking trainers, you know, and this guy turns up, you know, in proper like running gear and a sports car and all this, and you know, he took me down to the river and I thought he might throw me in, you know, and I just sort of huffed and puffed my way through about, 100 meters, and then needed to walk, and I was sort of bent over double, and the perspiration was pouring off me, and I just thought, this is not for me at all. And I remember apologizing profusely, and he just kept encouraging me and kept encouraging, and I'm so grateful and glad that he did, because I've got to go on this just ridiculous journey that I've had this amazing experience, traveled to some fantastic places and made memories that will last a lifetime. And it's such a great way to experience the world, right? Sometimes when you go on a trip, if you go on a coach tour or something, you could be anywhere really. You don't really get a sense of a place when you sit on a bus, but when you walk around or you run around, and you hear the people speaking, or you smell the the local food, and you feel the the surface under your feet and the climate and all that stuff, you really feel like you've been somewhere. And so I, one of the things I like to do as well as marathons is tourist park runs. So there's a 5K app, and there's these little challenges that you can do where you collect park runs. Usually there are challenges based on the names of the park runs. So there's one called the Compass Challenge where you find four park runs that include the words north, south, east or west, right? And you do those. And, they're kind of meaningless in some ways, but actually they kind of motivate you to go and see if you can get to somewhere else and travel to a new place. And so one of the things that park runners like to try and do is to collect the park run alphabet. So to run a park run starting with each letter of the alphabet. And they call it the park run alphabet because there is no X anywhere in the world. So there's Zs, but you have to go abroad to find a Z. And so collecting the park run alphabet is a great way to meet people and to travel to different places. And, and you get this sort of, I love all the stats as well afterwards. So you've got to figure out, what motivates you. Are you somebody that likes collecting things? Are you looking to improve yourself numerically? Are you just wanting to have, the experience? I mean, some people just go to the same park run every week and they love it.
And for some people, seeing the same familiar faces or hearing the same familiar voices, there's comfort in that, isn't there? And there's familiarity and that's okay. But for other people experiencing their county or the country or further afield, that's also great, isn't it?
Yeah. And, I can't always find a guide runner either. Sometimes I have weeks when nobody's available and I've got to go on the treadmill, in the garage, and it's I find it really boring, but just get a podcast on or the radio or whatever it is, and that's the kind of the last resort. And then also I try to do a little bit of cross training as well. So I've got a little exercise bike as well. So I sometimes do a bit of spinning on that, or I try and, go and splash up and down the pool, and, not very good at that, but, just trying to mix it up a bit.
So I was going to ask you before, do we know how many, I'm guessing we probably don't, but do you have any idea how many blind people have done the majors from sort of, to your knowledge, is there a record of that? Or
it's a great question, and there isn't an official record because it's just not something that Abbott collect data on. When you register with Abbott to do the majors, so each one is they call it a star, and so you collect your six stars, and they don't ask you any information about disability or it's just a demographic, like age, where you're from, that kind of thing. So it's really difficult to find out. And of course, as we know, a lot of blind and partially sighted people don't declare their blindness or whatever. So there will be people who maybe would meet the technical definition but would never necessarily identify as a blind person. I mean, certainly I know of three people, including myself, from the UK who've done the majors. So there's Mark Rogerson, and then there's another guy who I think lives somewhere down in the southeast. I'm curious to know, because it's going to be a pretty small group. I think you could probably count the number of people on your fingers who have completed this. There's only in the world, there are about 20,000 people overall, you know, who have done the majors as we, you know, record this. But that number, you know, will continue to rise. And there are lots and lots, there are tens of thousands of people who are on the kind of the journey. So there isn't a simple answer, but it's a pretty small group. And yeah, I can only think of two other people in the UK, and there must be, you know, because if you live in the US, right, you've got three of them are in the US.
Yeah.
Three of the majors are there. So I suspect there will be some Americans who will have done it. So it might be a question for Achilles. They might have a sense of how many blind people have done it.
Well, if anyone out there has done it and is listening to this, let us know.
Love to connect and compare notes and you know, find out how you got into the Tokyo Marathon and whether you paid off
how much did you have to spend. Oh, Dave, it's been amazing as always, and thank you so much for sharing your story. And all we can do is wish you the best of luck for Sydney, and we'll look forward to hearing when you've completed that and completed the 9, because I have no doubt in my mind that you will.
Okay, we might be doing part 3 in about
absolutely
5 years time or something. Thank you for this opportunity to share it, and I hope it does encourage somebody somewhere to, you know, just maybe try something new or to have another go at something that maybe you think, you know, you've got unfinished business with or whatever. Just keep on keeping on. And, you know, that's what VI Talks about, is encouraging each other, isn't it? You know, and supporting each other.
Yeah, definitely. So, oh, thank you, Dave. It's been an absolute pleasure. And
no worries. Yeah. Take care. Thank you.
You too.